Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. On this podcast, we talk with experts about applied psychophysiology, biofeedback, neurofeedback, and all things brain-related. These are conversations to educate, raise questions, have some fun, and help us all lead healthier, happier lives. Today's guide is Dr. Fred Schaefer, a biological psychologist, professor at Truman State University in Montana, current president of the Association for Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback, and owner of BioSource Software, providing educational resources for biofeedback and neurofeedback, and a sponsor of NRBS. Fred is giving a free webinar for the NRBS on March 14th about the myths of heart rate variability. I talked with him about this, wondering what some of those myths are and what misunderstandings about HRV led to them in the first place. Well, Fred, welcome back to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. It's always great to have you on the podcast. You're a sponsor of NRBS through your company, BioSource Software. And on March 14th, you're going to be giving a webinar titled Myths About HRV.
Yes.
We are all looking forward to. So first, you know, heart rate variability, it's a pretty well-known topic at this point, both among us biofeedback folks, applied psychophysiology folks, but also I think in the general public. But it's obviously, it's complex enough and the term is sort of thrown around enough that I guess myths have emerged about it. So that we're all starting from the same starting place, could you just give us your definition of HRV?
I just think of it as the fluctuation over time between the time intervals between successive heartbeats. So we have one heartbeat, there is the next one, there's an interval between them. And if the intervals are of different length, then we have variability. If the time interval are actually of the same length, then we have as a problem. We have a heart that is not capable of shifting to more challenging workloads.
And why is an optimal amount of variability, why is that healthy?
Variability is associated with the ability to adapt because our environment and our workloads are changing. There's a great deal of difference between sitting on a couch and getting on a treadmill. And even going from couch to treadmill, you need to up your game. And that variability allows us to shift gears. If you don't have variability, you're stuck in the lowest gear. Typically, hearts with very low variability are hearts that are at greater risk for a heart attack and all-cause mortality. And these are hearts that probably need a pacemaker.
And pacemakers nowadays, they do variable beating. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And that's important because you're not working at one set load. So you need variability. And variability means more than that. It also subserves what we call homeostasis. So it helps to more precisely adjust all the interconnected physiological functions, again, to promote health and performance. So it promotes control of blood pressure and breathing and so forth, so that we can better function.
So with heart rate variability, we're not just talking about the heart pumping blood, regulating that, but we're talking about respiration. We're talking about the autonomic nervous system.
And only we're talking about brain function, because we know from the excellent work by our colleague, Dr. Richard Gewurz, that there are heartbeat evoked potentials. And so the vagus nerve appears to communicate with the brain in that we can detect the signature of this communication in the EEG.
And so what are some of these myths that have come up that you run into, or that we all run into, actually?
At current count, in the presentation I'm preparing for NRBS in March, there are about 24. Now, we're not going to get through all of them today. And so in preparation for our chat, I asked myself, what are some of the most important ones? And one example is, if you're going to compare numbers, say values that you obtain during a resting baseline where people just sitting quietly and are not told to do anything except sit, no feedback whatsoever, then the best comparison will be a resting baseline of the same length. If it's much longer or much shorter, the numbers won't line up. That's a small one. So there is this problem of what is called cycle length dependence, so that if you are measuring heart rate variability, you need to measure using the same time periods. Okay, that's a small thing. Another myth is that we should expect to quickly see an increase in what we call low frequency band activity when we do HRV training, as well as an increase in some of those metrics like the RMSSD and the SDNN. Well, the reality is you shouldn't. You're not going to see a significant change for weeks. What you will see during training is you will see a large increase in the swings in heart rate that we call respiratory sinus arrhythmia. That's driven by breathing, purely parasympathetic. That will change, in fact, can be 4 to 10 times greater than when you started the session. But that doesn't result in persistent changes in heart rate variability as soon as you stop doing that. So people expect changes pretty rapidly, and they really won't see them.
Right. At least not in the heart rate variability. They may feel a little bit better because you have the increase in parasympathetic activity and maybe some reduction in oxygen to carbon dioxide, which is all good as well.
Wonderful changes. We encourage them.
So, you know, the use of heart rate variability, it's been around since, I guess, the early 90s when it was in Russia first. And, right. and then Paul Lehrer went over there, I think, early 90s and kind of brought it back to the States. It's been around since then, being used more and more. So why have these 24 myths or more, perhaps, why have they kind of come up? What's driving that?
Understanding HRV, even for so-called experts who teach it, is a steep learning curve. And often people who begin to use the modality learn enough to do effective training, but they typically have not done a deep dive into the foundational literature, such as the work by Gewirtz and Lehrer and Vashilo. Many people may cite the landmark document on heart rate variability that was published so many decades ago, but they haven't read it. And so you have this challenge of people know enough to do effective training, but may not understand the nuances. And that's a continuing job of my colleagues who do webinars and workshops on this topic to help clarify what are we really doing. I'll give you an example. One question that we often have is how do we know when HRV training is successful after a session's over with? And now we're looking at baseline again. Now, since during the session, we see large-scale increases in low-frequency activity because people are breathing somewhere around 4.5 to 6.5 breaths per minute, they assume that the way we keep score is by looking at low-frequency activity during a resting baseline. But in fact, the way to keep score is to look at high-frequency activity during the resting baseline, because the natural log of high-frequency activity is a serviceable proxy for parasympathetic tone or vagal tone. And so while people are expecting to see more low-frequency activity during the resting baseline, if you did see that, it would suggest that the vagal break is stuck, and that is not desirable.
And I can see where that particular myth is sort of reinforced, because the training screens mm-hmm. often focus on increasing low frequency.
Exactly, because I often liken it to people, perhaps curling a weight. And so during that time, you are pumping iron, and my students might say, your muscles are getting swole. But then you have to put the weight down. At that point, we don't expect your muscles to stay swole. Mm-hmm. Understanding how to keep score is very important. The purpose of the low frequency training is to increase high frequency activity because it is parasympathetic when we are at rest. And by resting, I mean breathing at typical rates, which might be 12 to 18 breaths per minute with no feedback whatsoever.
We'll go back to Dr. Schaefer in a minute. In the meantime, if you want to hear from more experts in biofeedback, neurofeedback, and applied psychophysiology, be sure to sign up for webinars at nrbs.org. Throughout the year, there are free talks, an inexpensive continuing education series, and a conference in the fall. Better yet, become a member. You'll get discounts for webinars and events, a monthly newsletter, and access to exclusive member gatherings. Go over to the website and join up. Now, let's return to my conversation with Fred.
Well, one of the things that I suspect drives this is the growth of wearable devices that by necessity have to provide a sort of a simplistic explanation of the heart rate variability. And I suspect also often focus on low frequency as well as the swing.
And let's talk about wearables for a second. That turns mm-hmm. out to be another myth. And that myth is that the measurements from wearables are trustworthy, that they're valid. Now, I absolutely do not want to criticize all wearables and their apps with a broad brush. What I do want to say is that wearables and their software that do not perform error correction, in other words, take out the bad beats, interpolate values for the bad beats, are going to be very misleading. I'll give you an example. An app that I use that I will not name has reported that my RMSSD, which is one of those summary measurements of heart rate variability, was under relaxed resting conditions, 140 milliseconds. Now, I can believe that I might have succeeded with about 35 milliseconds or 40, but we know that with age, HRV greatly declines. And as a result, 140 is just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so my assumption is that it mistook activity from some abnormal beats, maybe some movement artifact, as healthy heart rate variability. So I go back to the history of the Apple Watch and when they first introduced heart rate variability. My question to their support people was, what metric are you using? They didn't know. And by that, I mean the lower level technical support people, and mm-hmm. then the people they escalated to did not know. Eventually, they, in their literature, said, we're measuring the RMSSD in mm-hmm. milliseconds. But it's like trusting smartwatches and activity trackers to measure how many steps you've taken, to measure how many calories burned. There is a great deal of imprecision, in part because the FDA does not require precision for these measurements. If they were measuring blood pressure, that's a different story. Then there are critical tolerances that must be met. But it's a wild west for the HRV app, so that the measurements can be all over the place. Mm-hmm. So I urge caution in interpreting HRV measurements. At this point, again, here's the thing. If you are using a Polar H10 chest band and I'm using a well-designed app to acquire its values, and if you upload it and then do your own artifacting or use a application like Kubios to clean up your data, then you can trust it. But if you don't clean up your data, you can't trust your app to clean it for you, because it won't. Many of the apps do no data cleaning at all. Mm-hmm. Those that do may do minimal data cleaning, and they still can't handle premature ventricular contractions and premature atrial contractions.
Right.
And so they're overwhelmed and they can't tell the difference between real HRV activity and artifact.
So they may not be reliable.
If they're not valid, they're not reliable. Mm-hmm. Unless you have take the precautions I've mentioned, right. You have to be very careful. Now, my dear friends at the Institute of Heart Math do have software that will allow you to do some artifacting. Mm-hmm. And then you can analyze your data. You also can upload your values, your interbeat intervals, the time period between adjacent beats, You can upload it and then analyze it in an app like QBS. And HardMath has just produced a PPG sensor. So it's going to be an infrared sensor that samples 500 times a second, which is exceptional. And our lab at Truman is currently doing a validation study between it and an ECG sensor.
Well, that'll be good to see. Of course, they've been, I think they're the oldest still existing company that produces consumer equipment for measuring heart rate variability.
They clearly have been the leaders in mainstreaming HRV. They have put quality hardware and software into the hands of more professionals than the current crop of biofeedback vendors combined. Case in point, if you were to do a audit of, say, the VA system, you would see more HardMath systems in place than any other system.
Well, it is. Yeah, it remains popular, very popular, even with the other instruments coming out. So, as clinicians and as educators, how do we deal with these myths? You know, I think of when I'm working with somebody, trying to get into the nuances of it versus trying to provide an explanation that, you know, is good enough is a tough balance. I'm wondering if you have any advice for those of us out who are trying to dispel myths.
I think that often we don't know that we have bought into a myth until we listen to Ina Hazan talk about HRV myths. I have learned a great deal, as I always do, listening to Drs. Gewirtz and Lehr. Let me give you another example of a myth that I have been guilty of during my teaching career. And that was conflating HRV training with training at 0.1 hertz. You know, if your resonance frequency, and what I mean by that is the breathing rate or muscle contraction rate, is centered at 0.1 hertz, or effectively six breaths or six contractions a minute, then at that, in that case, it is 0.1 hertz training. But if your best stimulation rate is slower than that or faster than that, then it's not going to be at 0.1 hertz. And the practical significance of that is, if you're doing training and you don't see that 0.1 hertz peak, that doesn't mean training is failing. It may mean that you have instructed your client to breathe either more slowly or quickly than six times a minute. But many people will expect to see that peak at exactly 0.1 hertz. Because so much of the early training in HRV was at six times a minute.
So one thing we could do is do the a resonance frequency assessment, look at respiration at different rates and see how each of those affects HRV.
And my friends at Optimal HRV have built in to their app an H, a resonance frequency assessment. I have matched it with the results of a clinical grade assessment using Paul Lehr's earlier protocol, and found a very good agreement. Now, that's just an N of one. And so we have to take that with a few grains of salt.
Say it's an N of two, because I've actually done the same thing and found that it matched.
Yes. So I have confidence that it'll, at least will get you in the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it very simple because the optimal HRV subscription is fairly inexpensive. And you can use a Polar H10 or their HRV reader or a number of other devices that are cleared to work with it.
Not to talk perhaps about too much about one company, but they are also working on the problem of bad data and how to clean it.
We've talked about it.
Yes, I've talked with them about it as well.
They recognize it. It certainly keeps one of their founders awake at night, as it should keep every founder of these apps. Because even, as I said, even the apps that either collect data under very special circumstances, like you haven't moved for 5 minutes, or apps that do stop collecting data when they sense movement, or apps that remove a few bad beats, still can't do enough to make the measurements valid.
So you've been sending up some of these myths in your webtoon, Real Genius.
Yes.
Tell us about that. How did it get started? What are you doing with it? Or what are you hoping to do with it?
Okay. Real Genius actually started about the replication crisis in science. And I started it as a way of better educating my Truman State University students about science and both best and worst practices. I realized that it was a very good platform in which to deal with other scientific questions, such as HRV and the myths in HRV and myths in EEG and so forth. And so realizing that my colleagues, Don Moss and Ina Hassan, will be teaching this spring in Slovenia, I wanted to give them some webtoons, cartoons of HRV myths that might fit into some of their presentations. So we have put the webtoons, right now there are roughly 24 dealing with HRV. We've put them, slowly are putting them on the platform webtoons. We also are putting some of them on Shutterstock so that they can be licensed. And it's just another way of getting out scientific education. Now, to answer the question, why a cartoon? One of my colleagues, a former department chair, said, "Fred, with your webtoons, you're making a joke out of psychology." And he was saying that tongue very much in cheek. And my response was that sometimes these simple webtoons, cartoons, can in a very concise way communicate which an idea, complex idea that people might miss if you took 3 minutes to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it succinct. One of my collaborators called it pithy. We have a wonderful artist in Indonesia who has done these, and I fell in love with her artistic style, and then asked her to do the first ones, and have kept working with her now for at least a year and a half. And so it's a method of science. It's a effort at science education.
And we'll certainly link to the website in the show notes. So you check them out. Great. They're good. And I like the caricature types of who do you recognize? That's the question that you should ask yourself when you look at these.
And there are a number of people that colleagues who've been in the field for a little while will recognize. And I'm always anxious about, have we done justice to my colleague? And I start Danny with their headshots. And so she draws from there. And Dr. Kazan came out looking the best out of all of us. Dr. Moss got better looking as it went along. I did ask her to de-age him by 10 or 20 years. And so wrinkles were removed that shouldn't have been there anyway, at least to these older eyes. And I'll live with the way she has portrayed me.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we're wrapping up, do you have any favorite HRV myths or any that sort of make you, if not laugh out loud, at least have a chuckle?
You know, as I look at these, I don't laugh out loud unless I'm laughing at myself, because we all start as beginners. And there's still things that are hard to unwind or untangle. I think from conversations, again, with Dr. Gewurz, the idea that what we think of as everyday stress is fight or flight and sympathetic might be my favorite. And I think of fight or flight as being reserved for saber-toothed tigers and velociraptors, not for the typical worries and rumination that we often have. I think in that case, following Stephen Porch's perspective, it's vagal withdrawal, that the parasympathetic system is being suppressed. Now, it may be more complex than that, but people often think of fight or flight when in fact there's no evidence that people really are engaging in fight or flight when they are worrying or ruminating. And so that would be my favorite myth, because we have conflated as a society, as a culture, fight or flight with stress. And I would agree that, yes, there are situations that are really scary. And in those cases, it is fight or flight. In a lot of cases, it's going to be milder than that. And so instead, it's going to be what Porges would call vagal withdrawal. And the connection to biofeedback training is, when you see a peak during training in the very low frequency band that probably doesn't have to be sympathetic. It could instead be vagal withdrawal.
So kind of like a foot off the brake rather than pushing down on the gas?
Yeah, yeah. So it is, so yeah, these are interesting questions. What fascinates me is we have such a warm, supportive, encouraging community that we all teach each other what we've learned. And everyone starts as a beginner. And I know I have believed some of these myths during a good chunk of my career, even as I've taught HRV workshops and written on HRV topics. And so, but I think education is first of all lifelong, and it does involve inspecting, critically examining our beliefs and challenging them and revising them when they're inconsistent with the data. And the cool thing is my colleagues learn from each other, and none of us are so stuck in our ways or defensive that we can't say, oh my gosh, you're right, I've been explaining this the wrong way. So HRV has been a journey of humility.
Well, we appreciate you helping us along in our journey on this, and always learn something from you. And I do encourage our listeners to go over to the webtoon, Real Genius, and to really think about some of the things we believe, if not just about HRV, and we all have myths we believe in, and what we're doing with them, and how we're trying to correct them while still also trying to be useful to our patients and our students. So Fred, again, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
It has been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal, and our guide today to the Healthy Brain and Happy Body was Dr. Fred Schaefer, biological psychologist, biofeedback educator, and HRV mythbuster. Find out more about him and about his webtoon, Real Genius, in the show notes. You can also register there for his free webinar. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link in the show notes or wherever you get your podcasts. We really do want to hear from you. Be part of the ongoing conversation by contacting us with your thoughts, ideas, and questions. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Leave us reviews as well. It really helps podcasts like this one reach more listeners. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. This podcast is supported by the sponsors of NRBS, including Biosource Software, and the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us in our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.